Yes, hello, folks. Welcome to the weekly Manchester United podcast. I'm your host, as always, Phil Brown, joined by my regular co-host, fantastic James Rhodes, on this Monday afternoon here, the 2 days after United with the riveting victory over Everton. I'm sure you're all still on an emotional high, the excitement just flowing through your veins. Maybe we shouldn't be so particular, or shouldn't be so fussy, or shouldn't be such a bitch. 2-0, it's a win. We'll talk about that, of course. We talk about other things making United news that has happened since we recorded last. We'll talk about the, of course, the stadium that Jim Ratcliffe talked about last week. We'll talk a little bit about some of the things that Solskjaer said, which is quite interesting. Some of the other news, of course, surrounding the football club, potential signings, and why John Murta and Deco met this afternoon. First of all, mate, how you doing?
Pretty good. Not bad. Not bad today. And you?
All good, mate. All good. No complaints. 2-0 win at the weekend. The football is turgid. There's no doubt about that. It's a hard watch. The result, probably one of the only pleasing things about it. And whatever, I'm not 100% either way on Erik ten Hag, because I can find plenty of reasons why things are not his fault, and I can find plenty of reasons why I'm concerned. So I want to ask you about, first of all, what your opinion is on the game, the quality of football, and what your thoughts are on United going forward. So what was your thoughts about this weekend?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's quality-wise, it's not what we want. It's not there. It's not really different to what we've been watching the last few months, either way, or most of the season, really, which is fine. Another 20-something shots conceded, putting United, I think, second most shots faced in the Premier League. Not all high chances, to be fair. You know, it's not like these are all great shots, but it's a sort of obvious consequence of allowing teams a lot of possession against United more than they should. I mean, Everton are usually the second lowest possession team in the Premier League, I believe, and they I think they had more possession over the course of the game. Outside of the two penalties, which were fine, they were good attacks from United. I think the penalties were not like out of nowhere. They weren't nothing. You know, they weren't just like a total error. They were caused, I think, by United being aggressive in attack. And so I think it's the same. We've been seeing some good combinations in the front line that created some problems for Everton, leading to those goals. You got to take and finish those penalties, of course, too. You got to score them. Midfield completely non-existent to potentially even damaging over the course of the game. Looking at the passing, the quality, the standards there, it's kind of come to expect it at this point in time from here. And I just, it's not something I see changing this season. There's not really time. You're not really trying to change how you play in March in any season. You're just at that point in the year doing whatever it takes to get points on the board in whatever situation you're in. So I don't think that's going to change much by end of season.
Yeah. Look, there's lots of things to pick out here. I was watching this game at the weekend and I was reminded of a conversation I had years ago with Bruce Arena when he was at the Galaxy. And I was asking him about what were some of the biggest changes that had taken place in MLS. And he said, you know, in MLS, there used to be a time where you just needed to get 11 good players on the field and that would win you the game.
Right.
Now teams are far too tactically adept. They've got much more balanced quality throughout the team. You know, now you have to have a system. You have to have players that complement each other, that you have to have, you know, very astute tactically, and then you have to do different things. When I see Erik ten Hag's lineup, I see 11 fit footballers. And maybe they're not even completely fit. I see a team that would never be bought by a manager to play the way Erik ten Hag wants to play. I think, and I respect that everyone feels differently, one of the things that, which may be weird, this, but it sort of infuriates me the most that when I think about it, is the left-back situation and how a football club this size is going to end up playing three quarters of the season without a left back. That is a total disgrace. That is an absolute disgrace. That is something that any of us have to fix. That level of ineptitude planning is beyond belief. And inevitably against good teams, you're going to get punished for not having the left back. You know, we saw one of the worst periods of football under Ten Hag was when Amrabat was playing left back. And United were playing players at left back that just weren't left back. Then, of course, Luke Shaw comes in and United start to look like a football team again. It's not just the defensive side you miss out on, it's the offensive side. Shaw would give you so much on the overlap. I reminded of that Wolves game, you know, does the overlap ball across the box, Hoyland scores. Numerous times you'd see that. That takes out such a massive attacking dimension to your team, plus a defensive dimension to your team. And I honestly don't think that United can finish top four without a left back. I don't think you can finish top four where you're sitting with one foot fit fullback at the football club, no left back, a young 21-year-old striker who just turned 21, who's being over-relied on, a midfield that has no balance, very few legs. And I touched on some other stuff in my tweet that really is an abomination that's happening at this level. But this Erik ten Hag might be the last fall guy for the incompetence behind him. And if you think about the quality of the Premier League teams, asking a manager to finish in the top four, five, whatever, with one fit fullback and one half fit striker, fifth choice centre back playing the majority of your games, who was sent on a free transfer, who's 36 years of age, who you have no left footed centre back, you have no left footed left back. You're relying on a 19-year-old academy kid on the right wing. You have no striker for the last couple of games. This is disgraceful. And to expect, I don't care, forget whatever you think about Ten Hag, it's fine. But any manager in that situation should not be expected to finish top four. And I don't want to hear he spent 400 million because he didn't spend 400 million. United spent 400 million. Now, you can, that doesn't mean that he wasn't supported financially with high end players, but the number that you see spent is a reflection of United's incompetence, not what Ten Hag spent. And I get angry for a lot of the reasons that transcend Ten Hag.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it. When you look at the team as of this year, it's not fit for purpose for what you're trying to accomplish. One way or another, when you, in terms of balancing the profiles, the players, it's not fit for purpose. It's not a team that is solidly on its way to what needs to be done and how it's built. There's just too many problems with it, unfortunately. And, you know, it hasn't gotten better, I think, in a lot of ways, unfortunately, since Ten Hag arrived. Which we'd hoped it would be for many different reasons, but it's just not, you know. I think this summer they did a little better in terms of buying players that make sense. I think, you know, when you look at it, which is good, Andre Onana has become one of the major positives of the season for me, since obviously the Champions League stuff was pretty bad, but since then he's been quite good. He's got a really good mentality. He's a player I like. I would really like to see him succeed. And I think he will at United. Rasmus Hojlund has obviously come along, as it should. He could have been acquired for a lot less earlier in the summer, and that has nothing to do with Erik ten Hag, unfortunately for him. It still is an amount of money that United spent that they could have got for less. Mm. Mason Mount, I think, still could be a good purchase, but the situation with his medical side of things, you know, obviously is as crazy as it is with, in some respects, with Tyrell Malacia, you know, where he was supposed to be out for a month or two back in November, right? It was going to be 4 to 6 weeks. He was looking like he was going to come back, and then it was nothing. And then we hear nothing. And then we hear nothing. And now it's March, and supposedly he's going to be back after the international break. We saw pictures of him training.
Well, wait, two months ago. The article saying he wouldn't be back for the rest of the season, right?
Malacia, yes. Mason Mount, Mount's after the
They said at the end of December he was going to be back in 2 weeks.
Yeah, well, I don't know. And then you saw pictures of him in January training. And now it's March and he's still not made it and it's going to be 3 more weeks. I don't know. It's wild, but it is crazy these things that are happening there. And certainly the club isn't fit for purpose. And, you know, it goes a long way. When you talk about, you know, watching, which I did, and it is painful to watch how they play Liverpool versus City at the weekend.
No,
Liverpool are missing 4 starters as well at this point in time. However, when you watch the quality of their whole team and how players can slot right in and how it works, obviously this is 9 years of a manager being there, right? It's a long, long time from top to bottom, from academy on up, an exact precise way of playing that every single player will be drilled into to easily replace, where kids can come from the academy and they know how they're supposed to play football. In the first team, because it's how they've been playing for the last 4, 5, 6 years at the youth level. And that's the difference. That's the difference. That's why City can promote players to come in from the youth level and start to have an impact. That's why Liverpool can do it so easily. Not that we haven't, but there's a difference in terms of how it impacts the overall team. Kaby Mainoo comes in and plays really well because he's Kaby Mainoo. It has nothing to do with his style or how he fits into the team or anything like that. Frankly, you kind of almost have to fit the team around him. And, you know, Alejandro Garnacho will suffer if the team isn't set up to actually produce for him a way that he can focus on, you know, where it becomes a little less reliant on, you know, making moments of magic happen, which he's done and which Rashford did for many years when he came into the team, and a lot of players do, and then they start to slowly decline over the years. So, yeah, it's very frustrating to look at the difference between United and the other teams, and it's a top to bottom, and it's a years long problem. Obviously, this is a, you know, and it's a lot that has to go into fixing this entirely.
I mean, if you go back to what Ranić was saying about Klopp, you know, by that stage, remember 2017, Liverpool fans wanted the club out after losing to Leicester. Right? There was a massive outcry, they wanted him sacked. Arsenal fans wanted Arteta sacked. Okay. And if you go back to what Ranić said, was a 2021, about Liverpool have had a model. They've sent the players that they want to play a particular way, and they've built on that. And you get to a point where after 4 or 5 years of doing this, that you can be without 4 or 5 players because the whole squad that you've built up is players that you've bought. Yep. If you look at United's team in the weekend, Onana, Evans, and Casemiro were the only 3 players that Ten Hag bought. The rest were not his players. These are players that being bought over multiple different managers, some going back to Mourinho. Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, they're not bad footballers, right? In the right team, they'd be really good footballers if they were playing to their strengths, no question about it. But how do you get an embedded style of football when you're constantly toggling between 4th and 5th choice players, putting players in positions at left back that shouldn't be there, have never played during their careers, you know, multiple players on loan? I mean, if you think about what Ten Hag came to, Ten Hag came into a football club. You go to his first window. He signs Lisandro Martinez for 55 million, and Malacia for 12 million, and Christian Eriksen on a free. That's what they started the season with. Mm-hmm. Then they panic after Brentford, and United spent money they didn't intend on spending, because at this stage, the Glazers had already decided that they were going to put the football club up for sale.
Yep,
because United financially didn't have the resources. The pot was dry, and they didn't want to try to sell a football club on the back of multiple crises. You know, team viewer at that stage are already threatening to bail. Lots of things going on. The players actually go to the board with whatever thing, and they go out and sign Casemiro and Antony for inflated fees, players they could have had way before, earlier in a window, for much less. So, of course, that looks like Ten Hag spent all this money, but it's not. Again, it's horrendous planning. His next window, he gets 3 on-loan players. He gets Jack Butland, Marcel Sabitzer, Wout Weghorst. Wout Weghorst will never play for a top club again, nor will Jack Butler, if he ever did. and Sabitzer's at Dortmund, which is just a level below. Then this window comes along. They have no money. The Glazers intend on paying down that credit facility. So now they go for Mason Mount because Chelsea will take no money up front and they'll take payments. Decent player, but a risk because he played, what, 9 games a season before?
Yeah.
Then, you know, they start again. You know, the Hoyland, they delayed it because the intention was we'll reintroduce Greenwood. Right? Oh, shit. Now we got to get rid of Greenwood. Now we got to get rid of Sancho. And the recruitment again this summer, you know, Onana has eventually come good. Hoyland recently come good. So you have to give Ten Hag some credit there that these signings have worked out. But again, the preparation is horrendous. Just dreadful. Right? It's so Ten Hag has to start the season not just losing no Greenwood, but also Sancho. Mm-hmm. You could handle the Sancho thing better. I agree. But, and then he gets to this January, and he can't bring a single player in, despite the fact Anthony Martial is out for 4 months. Mm-hmm. And you're going, this is, they let Reguilon go. Their only fit left back on what? On the basis that Luke Shaw, who's never stayed fit for a whole season once, and Ty Malacia, who's been out for a year, is going to be fit. This is insane. I mean, you look at this and this genuinely defies belief. It's that incompetent.
Yeah, it is. It is. And unfortunately, it's, results in what essentially is a wasted season overall. And ideally, you have no wasted seasons, you know, in football, because it takes so much work to get back to the top. Even when you're not competing, you can't have a wasted season. You can't have a season where you make no progress, because you can make progress without winning things. You can make a lot of progress without winning things, but you have to have the resources to make that progress. You have to have the ability to do that. You have to have players to do it. Not every year is a win, but every year you can gain something. You can get something out of it. And I can't say that there's a single thing that they would have gained out of this season, frankly, as a whole, as a team, right? Obviously, there's been some good players, but on the other hand, you also have good players who become a year older, a year closer to their decline, a year closer to moving away. You see players like potentially Bruno Fernandes, who, you know, how many years does he have left at performing at this level? Is it even enough now where you can say, yeah, we're starting the next phase with Bruno Fernandes? Is it too late for that? And now it's another position. So, yeah, infinitely frustrating in that regard. And I think, you know, at this stage in time, overall, it's really going to be kind of a matter of, I think it's a little too late in the year for there to be much of an influence. And I know this isn't how the decision is going to be made. As I said this a few times about manager, things like that, it's a bigger picture decision. I don't think they're going to be reactive negatively or positively to any game that occurs now, because it's very little you can read into it, you know, either way, right? You know, because what you're not judging a manager on at this stage, you're not judging them on their ability to, you know, scrape games in a crisis either, even though it is a positive for somebody to do that and to make those changes. And so, you know, what has to happen is really what has had to be happening all along for this to work. And that's why it's not a one-year thing. And it does need to be, whatever comes next, a long-term decision. It needs to be, this is how we're going to play, this is how we're going to recruit, and this is the manager for it. And if it's Ten Hag, then it'll be Ten Hag. And then I think he will get 3 years on a deal. Not wait until next season, like we've talked about, because I don't think that makes any sense in the slightest. And so, you know, I think that they'll hope either way that we can get something out of this season to help with next season, to help with the finances and Champions League and all that. Not to skip ahead, but interestingly on that, there was also news, we probably want to talk about that, changes to the whole PSR formula for this summer to be more in line with UEFA's spending, which is something interesting to discuss as well.
Yeah, but we'll get that. But yeah, this is a bit stricter actually than what the Premier League is.
Yeah,
because UEFA have a lower percentage of turnover that you're allowed to use for wages. Yep. Maybe there's some other nuance I'm not aware of that gives them some more flexibility. But, you know, yeah, I mean, you just said, I was sitting looking about this, thinking about this over the weekend. We'll talk about Ahmad Traore in a little bit. But, you know, you look at what United paid for Ahmad, what, 37 million?
Yeah, well, we've probably only paid 19, to be fair. Oh, there, there, but surely those add-ons haven't gone in, you know?
Let's be generous and pay 19, but they refused to pay 20 for Haaland?
Yeah.
How can you pay 19 for Ahmad Traore and say, but we're not paying 20 for Haaland?
I know.
Luis Diaz signs for Liverpool for 37 million. I mean, and Julian Alvarez signs for Man City for 17 million.
Yep.
Two players United could have had. And chose not to move. I mean, I'm sitting there going, Haaland, Ahmad, Diaz. I'm like, this is infuriating.
And then they'll say, Caicedo when he signed for Brighton,
11 million on Palestri.
Yeah.
It is, by the way, he's having a decent loan spell.
He's actually doing pretty well.
Yeah, he's going to play five games. But anyway, it's infuriating. And you look at 72 million on Sancho or 71 million and 85 million on Antony, and neither of them are anywhere close to people like Luis Diaz.
$200+ million on wingers that we can't use, not to mention Mason Greenwood into the factor
too. Yeah, well, we'll get to him.
Insane.
So anyway, on the positive side with Ten Hag, where I will get Daphne give him credit, Garnacho's now started 25 games in a row. And I genuinely don't think Garnacho gets the credit he deserves for the level of talent that he is. He is a stupendous talent and was so important to United getting 3 points at the weekend, frightened the life out of Everton, ran at them directly. And then there's an individual, I'm not going to name him, I'm going to spare him. But the Manchester Evening News, he decided that there was an article in this, which I genuinely think it's beyond parody. I can't believe that I read it. I just can't believe that an editor decided to publish this. To criticize Alejandro Garnacho for daring to show emotion that he got a penalty. And I'm sitting there and I'm going, you know, I just remember Pedro Neto celebrating that Wolves got a penalty against United. I can't remember that reaching the level to provoke someone to podium. Remembering numerous times Rodri celebrating, same thing when he got a penalty against United at Old Trafford. And yet somehow you've looked at 19-year-old Alejandro Garnacho showing pleasure that he is correctly awarded a penalty kick.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And thinking he can do better. What the fuck do you want? I mean, sorry, my language, but what the fuck do you want? Are you insane? Well, I mean, what would have been the correct reaction there? Oh, sorry, jolly old chap. I'm really sorry you fouled me in the box. And you know what? In the interest of fair play, I'm going to say how disappointed I am that the referee gave that penalty kick. And maybe Bruno, you should just kick it over the bar and let's be gentlemen about this here. What the fuck are you talking about? I mean, it's so absurd, the over-policing of United players.
I know.
Maybe Ten Hag should have tipped his barber a little bit more. You could do better there. So could you, George. So could you. You're a journalist. That's what you should have your press pass revoked for that. You went to Manchester United match and you proved an article out of that?
Yep.
Are you insane? Is that where the levels of journalism have gone to? Where you're, let's find something, anything, a microaggression. You know, that we can criticize Manchester. I mean, that is offense, man. That is someone who goes, I need to find something that I can criticize these people for. Because you cannot. I mean, how many times have this ever bothered you that a player has got a penalty against you? Never.
Yeah.
What do you want? I mean, how much of a funny are you where you that would bother you? Seriously, I mean, that is so absurd to me. It bothers me way more than it should, but I just look at him like, this is ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. I can't understand how someone, a journalist, would have the balls to turn around and go, you know what? This is Pulitzer Prize level shit.
Mm-hmm. No, I hear you. I hear you. I mean, look, the simple fact of the matter is, and some people are going to find this out a little bit later, is that, you know, there's a lot of people who feed off the negativity
of course. With United,
and they've made a living off of being negative about United. And
someone was dug out rightfully for it yesterday, I might add.
Yeah. And when things get good, it's going to be a lot harder to produce that kind of stuff and to write those things when things do turn around. And that'll be one of the reasons why, you know, I was listening to some of the guys on, one of the guys on Stretford Paddock, they were talking with James Ducker the other day. And it's an interesting opinion about United, because they were talking about how United is very much, once it gets going, it'll really get going. Really, really get going, because it's so huge. And there's a lot that goes into it when you think about it, because there's so much made out of digging out United, right?
Of course.
Digging out the players, digging out every little aspect of them. And a lot of people who make a living off of that, right?
Because
now.
What? It means strengthens engagement.
This is yeah, the problem. Exactly.
The media is created where there's an outreach farm. And, you know, it's just human nature. Our brains wired to see threats, negativity, more than it is to see positivity. So it provokes reaction. Sorry, go ahead,
Exactly. And so, you know, when things get good and they can't do this anymore, and you have to write about what's good and people are having to cover it, the amount that it will steamroll, and it will make a difference. Because, you know, one could say, you know, the players have to get tougher, things like that. That's all true, too. But once there's sort of a something that turns and folds over to where it's just heavy support for the players, for the coaches, for everybody involved at this club, and there's a lot of positivity behind it, it will have an effect on them. I mean, you see it in the game. Sometimes it takes its time, and I think fans are tired and frustrated after years. So it doesn't happen as much as you like it to, but you see it at times in Old Trafford in the stadium. Once it really gets going, how it can drive things and how it can push things moving forward. I mean, you've seen them, you saw it under, you know, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer pre-COVID, the final game pre-COVID, the win against Manchester City will always stand out to me as one where that doesn't happen without the amount of force and support coming from people around the players, from the fans, from everywhere, and kind of the entire emotional push that goes with it, because it was an incredible game and maximum effort, maximum energy, maximum intensity. And that's what you want. And I think that United is, you know, when things do get good, you know, a lot of these people will be found out and it'll be for the better. And a lot of good will come of it.
James, here's the thing, like, there's positive and negative human beings, right? Mm-hmm. There's certain people, and I won't name them, they can find as a dark cloud and every silver lining.
Yeah.
Right? And I go back to what I just said there about Garnacho, where there's an offense mining operation. I'm going to find something to be pissed off about, because that's what I feed on. And that will attract a certain type of person. And a football club like United, the pendulum swings heavy both ways. Right? If it's going that negative because of the level of support, it reaches a crescendo of abuse and negativity, and it's a terrible place to be.
Yes.
Going positive, you know, you can drown out the darkness, you can drown out the noise, because you're going to get a lot of love. That's probably one of the best places to be.
Yeah.
But there will always be those who occupy a certain space who are incapable of adding anything of journalistic integrity and merit.
Yep.
And no matter how much you are held captive by the football club to behave and try to stop being so negative and try to stop spreading abuse and to offer an incentive of interviews, if you do this, it's still a difficult place to occupy, because they've built an audience on negativity and they don't like positivity. So trying to rebrand yourself when you've spent 10 years being someone that spread toxic abuse is going to be really difficult, because there's better people at occupying that space than you. And that's just not how you built your audience.
Yeah.
The other issue is, these are the types of people that attract fans of players, not the club, or fans of a team, not the club. So their support differs based on, is it my favorite guy that's a manager? Is my favorite player playing? Yeah. You know, I mean, the amount of stuff I read on my Twitter from so-called United fans, it's hard to believe. I mean, I could read some of them to you, and you go to their Twitter pages, and they're supposedly United fans, and nobody abuses players or the club like these people to nobody.
Yeah, it's
you'll find out that 99% of their tweets are about one particular player, one particular guy, and you're like, these are not Manchester United fans, right? So they'll always find, so their player isn't playing, some other guys aren't scoring 40 goals a season, it'll be the manager's fault. I mean, to me, it's Ten Hag's fault I'm not playing for Man United, and he's picking Rasmus Højlund ahead of me. You know, if only he ruined my career, because if only he could see how good I was, you know, and that wasn't picking favourites and picking Højlund ahead of me, I'd be scoring. This is the logic that people use online. The manager ruined the player's career. No, every footballer's kicked the ball, you know, will tell you that there's a reason why I don't make it to the next level. I want to get to him and talk about that in a minute. But a lot of the toxicity that's out there is a farm. It's a business. And, a couple of weeks ago, Jonathan Liu, who I have the utmost respect for, by the way, wrote an article saying that United said they would not pursue high-end Hollywood personalities, you know, appointments. And here they are going after Dan Ashworth. I'm like, you're fucking joking. Dan Ashworth is what? I mean, I'll be honest. I barely knew who he was about 4 weeks ago, right? Was he a celebrity when Newcastle went after him? Or is there only a celebrity because United are going after him? Because I guarantee you there was nobody writing an article about Dan Ashworth being a celebrity when Newcastle were going after him. I mean, this is absurd. The levels, the standards the United are held to on everything is so far above and beyond. I mean, I just to finish this up, I go back to what I was saying last week about Man City. You know, the Qatar buys United, football's over, your success means nothing. By the same people, then lauding Manchester City and how wonderful they are. Like, I mean, your own hypocrisy should embarrass you.
It's all good. I agree, and no, it is something. It is something, and you know, I know that we've all at times been a part of it because it's been. It's all good. You know, we've all been. I think as United fans, because things have been bad, there's been many times it's hard to be positive. It's hard to not, you know, get into the thing of talking about players and abuse and, well, not abuse necessarily, but there's a lot of abuse out there. But it's hard not to fall into the trap of being overly critical and overly negative at times because there's been so much, you know, where it's like reality has often been so negative that it reflects it. But the difference is always, you know, if you're finding things where there's nothing and, you know, being fair and things. And I think it's something that my hope is, you know, under new leadership and all that, and I've made an effort to be better at this in recent months too, because I think it's important. I think there's far enough, you know, negativity out there in the world for sure. No doubt about that going on. You know, I've really hoped that with new leadership, you know, we can, as fans kind of ideally come together on certain things and back what they're going to do, because we may not all always agree on many different things from an opinion standpoint. But I know that there are people who want to make the right decisions now and want to do the right things for United. And, and I think that is something we can agree on. Hopefully the majority of us, that, you know, these are people who have the right intentions and they deserve our support in doing that. And obviously they'll have to prove themselves, but they still deserve support.
You also have to remember that a lot of this is being amplified and fed by people that aren't even United fans, that are pretending to be United fans.
Yeah.
These are people that are individuals who are assigned to certain agencies that are schooled on a particular way to behave that drives engagement. And we see this with young females who, have two buckets in the wardrobe hanging out with the United scarf from and going, come on, the boys, you know, that are used Manchester United to promote their OnlyFans monitor, right? So this is the male version of this, of people who are pretending to be United fans to build their own profile off the back of it. So they contaminate the discussion around the football club because they're not United fans. I mean, it's blatantly obvious. So that is a problem. And hopefully the football club gets some balls and grow a set of balls and have some standards and start refusing to work with certain people. Okay, United are entitled to work with whoever they want, but there should be some editorial standards about what you do. And there's certain things I could say that I'm not going to say that would be quite interesting to add some context to what I'm saying. But United should not be feeding this because I've spoke to certain United players and I can 100% validate what Andy Mitten was saying about Rasmus Højlund, that is exactly how a number of United players genuinely do feel towards that particular organization. But it's not to me. Let me ask you quickly about Casemiro, because I heavily criticized at the weekend. He gave the ball away 6 times in 20 minutes. I feel for him a bit in the sense that he's isolated and that it's a midfield that United are asking him to do stuff that he doesn't have the legs to. In many ways, it would be better for him to go from England to Spain at this point of his career than Spain to England. In Spain, you get a lot more time. You get, you know, you're not having, it's not 100 mile an hour. You have a whole different set of ground to cover. Casemiro obviously is a very good footballer. And I've no doubt that if you were playing for Real Madrid, he wouldn't be giving the ball away 6 times in 20 minutes. I'm sure some of this is based on the way United are set up. But this is obviously a big concern. Something that, a little anecdote from Solskjaer talking about how United need legs in the midfield. And I felt that some of that was targeted towards Casemiro.
Well, yeah, you know, it's really interesting because two players that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was extremely complimentary of were, of course, two players who are often maligned by United fans, which was Fred and McTominay. And he argued a bit with Roy Keane about Fred and was insistent he would be someone he would pick every time because he knows what he's getting from him, from an effort level, from a legs, covering space, doing the things that he does. And that United are frankly missing a little bit this year too. But I think so because, you know, it's a tricky situation for Casemiro. I don't think that what he's being asked to do out of necessity or however suits his skill set, especially at this point in his career. You know, yeah, he gives the ball away a lot. It's hard to think of midfielders who would be asked to cover the spaces he has to cover and make the passes he has to make. Many of them, you know, first-time passes on the turn, things like that, evading pressure, that would be able to do that job. I don't know that there's many in the world. And the number six position, I think, is the most important position in football. You know, that role, that deep midfielder role, is probably, to me, the most impactful position in football. You see even Manchester City struggle recently this season when they didn't have Rodri in the team. Obviously, he's a tremendous player, but it's a really difficult role in general. It's a hugely difficult role in general. And in England, you know, you don't get, you know, Sergio Busquets was able to play well past his legs going for Barcelona, well past his legs. You know, he's never the fastest player in general, but he was able to play well past that. And in the Spanish league, it's extremely technical, but definitely slower in a sense. And I think it's tricky because it's almost an unfair ask. I don't think there's anybody else in the team who could do that job any better. I don't think that there is. I mean, I think you could change the structure a little bit and just bring Kobbie Mainoo deeper and go back to the two deep like we always used to, and it would be a bit safer, a bit more secure. But it's a tough role. It's a tough role. Yeah, it's unfortunately Casemiro is on the wrong side of the peak of his career for that role at this point.
I would be surprised if he's still a United player come the summer.
Yeah,
no matter what happens, no matter where he finishes, I think he is definitely, if United are to ever challenge, if you look at United's rivals in that position, they're not carrying older players there. You know, they've got players in the peak at the peak of their career. I mean, Liverpool had to think about this with Jordan Henderson. They had to think about this with other midfielders too. They had to bring in younger midfielders to bring some legs into that midfield, which they did. With, you know, they brought in Szoboszlai, when he's a winger, brought in McAllister, brought in Endo, what have you. They wanted Romeo Lavia and stuff. They were trying to bring in younger players to bring that legs back into the midfield, which is similar to the way Ten Hag wants to play. Then he needs that energy in midfield. You know, he's been... Thankfully, Kobbie Mainoo's coming through that gives him that. But Manu needs someone in beside him.
Yeah.
And I think with Casemiro, you know, in some sense, you see this is part of the reason why he gets so many bookings is because of the pace. And this is something that I don't think he's ever really had to deal with. But, you know, the Premier League is unbelievably quick. Amad Diallo. Mm. Very interesting today that he removed Manchester United from all his social media platforms. That was not an accident. From his Instagram, from his Twitter. If you go on to his Twitter, it's all Sunderland stuff. Obviously, young man that would have wanted to have been playing recently. A lot of United fans think he should be too. There's a reason why he isn't. What do you think's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult situation because, you know, as far as we know, you know, they didn't want him to go on loan in January so that he would be available. He didn't go to AFCON as well, I think, so that he would be available. And he's not playing. He's not playing at all. He's played 18 minutes, I think. You know, you're up 2-0 against Everton. He doesn't come on. So there's obviously a reason, right? Amari Forson kind of came into the team then and started getting minutes as well ahead of him. Somewhat surprising when you look at how things have gone. I don't know. You know, there was something a little while ago where there was something that was supposedly an accident on social media from him liking a post or something like that. That, as far as I know, was certainly, I mean, I can't say that, there was something he liked about not playing or not getting minutes or just some tweet. And I can't remember what it was. There was some clarification of it, but it came at the same time as pretty solid rumors. So I can't say he liked the post on purpose because I don't know that, but it came at the same time as some pretty solid rumors that he was unhappy with how things were going. And then at the same time, he happens to like this post and it's an accident, right? But now we see he's still not playing. And weeks later, you know, this is happening. There's to me, there's obviously something going on with him where I can't say he's in the right on this at all in the slightest, but either way, there's something going on where he's unhappy with the situation at United and not playing.
Let me be devil's advocate first for a second here. Is it concerning to you that of United's front line, they've had major problems with Anthony? They've had major problems with Jadon Sancho. They've had major problems with Marcus Rashford. They've had some problems with Anthony Martial. They've had now problems with Amad.
Mm-hmm.
Lestri wanted to leave the summer. His father was not happy that he was not allowed to leave. Lestri was also someone who felt that Ten Hag was showing favoritism, which is understandable for players that don't play. You know, this happens in every dressing room across the world where players don't play. It doesn't matter what level at, okay? Players always feel they should be playing ahead of someone else. That's always the case.
Yeah, of course.
They have problems with Ronaldo. And I'm looking at this and going, if there's one thing that also really infuriates me, is when I look at the likes of Liverpool, Arsenal, City's goal difference.
Mm-hmm.
Plus 45, plus 43, and United are zero. They don't score goals. Marcus Rashford feels that his role in the team changed this season as a result of Rasmus Højlund being brought in.
Yep.
You know that Casemiro was really upset whenever Ten Hag done that interview saying that they needed more football. They took him off at halftime because they wanted more football. He wasn't happy about that. He's had an issue with Varane. He's had an issue with Wan-Bissaka. and you're going, is that a concern to you?
It's a lot. I mean, I've never seen this many issues with players, even on teams that were having problems, right? And in difficult situations. I've never seen, I've never seen this many. And it is concerning. It is kind of crazy to look at it because it is a concern. I mean, it's hard to know, you know, the blame on it, but when you kind of look at it in one way, you have no team can afford to have falling outs with multiple hundreds of million worth of players. You just can't. It's you know, and I've said that in taking it off of Ten Hag, that it should be measured by and dealt with by other people.
I agree.
Because it's to me, I think Ten Hag has to take responsibility for a good portion of getting along with people, because it's part of being a good leader. You can't just rule everybody with an iron fist. It doesn't work, and no good leader does that. But a lot of the weaknesses of people that you have is encompassed by having proper organization, proper planning, proper setups, in order to prevent these things from occurring. Because how let's say you do have a manager who pisses everybody off, because Jose Mourinho pissed off a number of people too. Not as many, but a number of high profile people like Paul Pogba and Anthony Martial back then. Though I would certainly say in retrospect, Jose Mourinho was probably right about a lot of those things that he indicated, right? Yeah, you'd have to say that that's the case, right? Either way, giving the ability of a manager to cause problems or to create something or to have a situation where a manager could is responsible for, like, when you give somebody too much responsibility, you're also saying that they have the ability to mess it all up in a manner way more than you should. And that's not even to blame the individual. It's like, it, you know, it comes to recruitment, it comes to everything, that the manager's been such a huge figure at United for too long, trying to recreate Sir Alex's role at United for too long. So, but it is concerning. I mean, it's concerning because it's obvious that it's an issue and there's a serious lack in something going on that is making, you know, that is not creating a good environment for these players to understand. Because mostly I think it's been about football. It's been about playing, you know? I mean, at the end of the day, it's been mostly about that with pretty much everybody, about playing. And one thing I will say, just as a note on this, is that one of the underrated factors, I think, in leadership is predictability. You want to be predictable. People want to know where they stand, and they want to know what their future looks like in any situation. And sometimes I think that's an underrated aspect of leading. It's not just doing things on merit. That you do have to give a bit of predictability within that too, where people can know, some way of knowing, if I do X, Y will happen. They have to have some degree of knowing that.
So on that, I think there's a larger thing here. When you need a transition from Busby, Franco Farrell, and what have you, they found it really difficult. One, I can understand a football club being stuck in a rock in a hard place, being make sure you don't disrespect Sir Matt Busby, you know, the great at that point, and may still be the United's greatest ever manager. The problem is when you're transitioning from a legend like that, the only way to give the next manager a chance is to have them completely leave the football club, because they cast a massive shadow over the club. And you would, I'm going to finish this by talking about what Solskjaer said about Ferguson.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you listen to what the likes of Franco Farrell was saying, players were still going and calling Sir Matt boss, still had the manager's office. You can't lead in an environment like that because your word has no respect, no authority. And every parent knows that a weak parent who doesn't hold the line when it comes to implementing discipline not only undermines the other parent that's trying to bring discipline, but doesn't help the individual. Because empty promises produce, or empty threats produce, worse behavior. It's as simple as that. Yeah. So for Ten Hag, he has to, you heard about this with Solskjaer, when Solskjaer was saying, leave out Ronaldo, you know, have to deal with all the, you know, the histrionics, but the camera would pan to him. And there's some debate about how Solskjaer said this or what he actually meant, but when you have to deal with a gaffer, you know, was it that could be video? I don't know. But this is the problem when you have John Murdoch working at the club who Ferguson doesn't like because of the David Moyes situation, right? When you have ex-players who used to play for Ferguson, who there's too many sympathetic ears to players who can go to within the club and undermine people like the manager when they're not playing, when this is happening or that's happening. There's too many people in managerial positions, upper management positions, who maybe don't like the manager, who, you know, maybe there's no synchronicity between certain departments that don't like each other. The medical department doesn't like the manager. The director of football doesn't like the manager. The manager doesn't like the director of football. You know, the Keith Voss situation. You know, there's all so many competing agendas because there is no unity. And Rick have talked about this, about who Ten Hag should be reporting to.
Yeah.
Everything, those standards should be in concrete, derivative of the football structure, nothing to do with the manager. If this manager wasn't here, you would still have to do this. This has got nothing to do with the manager. The manager is not the one implementing the discipline. These are not standards that are explicit to him, exclusive to him. These are the club standards. You don't sign for Erik ten Hag, you sign for Manchester United. You will abide by our standards, club standards, and if you don't, the club will be the one that will bring the discipline. There's too many sympathetic ears for players when they're left out or they're not playing that they can go to and complain, and people will use their own ego to undermine others they don't like. That's a big problem.
For sure, and I think in the reverse, what you say has the positive effect too when I talk about predictability, when you know that the standards are there from the club, not from a manager, because managers change. And they change their ideas too. I'm not just saying managers as people change. They change their ideas. They change their needs. They change how they view things all the time. But the club standards have to be the same. And that tells somebody, as long as I do this, I know it'll be positive for me at this club. And I am sticking to the high, and it should be high standards, but the high standards that are being set by the club. And you get continuity. And I think you get a lot more happier players too. The bad eggs would be weeded out. And players who are just confused would sort them, would get sorted, and you wouldn't end up with these kind of issues across the board.
Okay. Let me ask you about what Ratcliffe was saying about the new stadium. So as expected, it looks like Ratcliffe prefers the building of a new stadium. How it's going to be financed is going to be interesting. It looks like there's going to be commercial investment partners involved in this. I think he's been a bit smart in getting the government on side with Lord Coe and, of course, Andy Burnham. I think that was a smart move because perhaps we'll get some government buy-in. Now, I completely understand fans said government should not be funding football stadiums, and I've said before I agree with that, despite West Ham, despite City, despite other clubs having government assistance in the construction of the stadium. I agree that that shouldn't be happening, but nonetheless, that's where we're at. What do you think of a new stadium at Old Trafford?
Yeah, I mean, I've expressed my view on this, that I think, and I'm not surprised by it at all, that they view it this way. I think the view is pretty simple when you're talking about these guys. You know, they're business people, they're finance people, end of the day. At this top level, the guy's making this decision, right? To be competitive at the top end, you have to have the maximum finances available. Mm-hmm. And you know, in reference to, for example, these UEFA finance rules about spending as a percentage of revenue, which will likely be the Premier League rules moving forward, well, you have to absolutely maximize the top end revenue that you have. And a new stadium will increase the lid or the ceiling on United's potential revenue by allowing for so much more by way of commercial opportunities. And I think it's for them, it's that simple. I mean, there's a lot of other positives that go with it in terms of revitalizing the area, the things that can be around there. But why do you want to do that from a financial perspective? Mm-hmm. Is because it's going to open the door for more commercial opportunities, for more events, for more things to be sold, essentially. Whether related to United or just related to the stadium as a property and the club and their ability to do these things. It makes sense to me. It does. It's altogether logical. If the other clubs are doing it, you kind of have to, or you'll end up falling behind if you're losing out on one of the biggest revenue streams that you can, which is, of course, you know, I mean, match day revenue is a huge revenue stream. If there's more ways to expand that, then they will. But as well, you know, packing in people to the stadium and getting for different events and things like that. And it's just money. It's just money at the end of the day from that perspective. Obviously, that's not an emotional or nostalgic perspective on the whole thing in general, but it's the reason. It is the reason why that they're looking at this and why they favor that. And I would say that it's maybe a little bit like, I don't know what's the word for it, sacrilegious to say it, right? But some of viewing football success as the highest priority does come at the cost of history and does come at the cost of some of the nostalgic things that people do have because they are emotional, you know, standpoints. Mm. And it's a tough argument in that respect. And like I said, it sounds kind of poor in one sense, but it's true. I mean, you know, United in some sense have suffered by being beholden to history a bit too much and not getting, you know, with the modern, with some of the modern things going on. And I think the stadium is one of those areas.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be interesting to see as past talk about keeping Old Trafford's capacity and using it for the women's stadium.
I think would be very nice to do that. I think that would be ideal, being able to keep it as a ground that is useful for the club.
Yeah. And so in some sense, if it was kept, I don't know, maybe even as a museum or some sort where the link to the history was retained, then I think that would be something that I could definitely support. We did talk about Mason Greenwood and looks like John Murta and a few other United staff were in Barcelona with Deco. The belief seems to be that was regarding Mason Greenwood, who's had a quite successful spell in Spain with Getafe. What's your understanding of that, my friend?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say that I know 100% anything about them, you know, specifically going to Barcelona, except for sure we have discussed previously that there is interest, you know, from Barcelona, from Atletico, from the big Spanish clubs in Mason Greenwood, where there doesn't seem to be an issue with him and his career there. There's no problem really at all. He's having a successful season. I don't foresee any issues there. Obviously, a decision wouldn't have been totally made on selling him, but it's something where when you talk about finances, the sale of Mason Greenwood can have a huge positive impact on United's books. And on that, I want to discuss how that relates potentially specifically to Barcelona. You know, Barcelona is also a club that has, at the moment, some very difficult financial problems. And one of the ways that you avoid financial problems in football, or that this can be done where you can make transfers, is when you talk about swap deals, especially when you're talking about academy products where there's pure profit. You swap Mason Greenwood for someone like Balde, their left back, who's an academy product, or it would be pure profit. And you put both of them at, you know, 50 million or 60 million on the books as a sale. You get that whole profit of 60 million on that sale this year, but you get to write the buy against a 5-year period on amortization. You don't actually send any money both ways, but it's a sale and a buy on both ends. And it's totally legitimate to do that. It is normal, pretty normal accounting practice. From, you have to be careful not to inflate things. Sometimes teams have gotten in trouble for that, for ridiculously inflating things where they, you know, are saying 75 million for a player. I think Juventus did this with Barcelona, but yeah, 75 million. Yeah. 75 million for a player that's clearly worth, you know, 30, 35. But, you know, I think that with a player like Mason Greenwood, it's an interesting thing because it allows you to avoid a lot of the drama that surrounds it if it's done in this manner, because you're not actually receiving any money for him, which, you know, some people have already been writing articles about.
Making one or two people happy that don't think they'd be allowed to make money off of that.
But yeah, I think it avoids it.
Relatively interesting new standard that's being applied.
I know.
It's, you know, what about the club?
Never been applied anywhere else, you know?
It's just, anyway, okay, whatever. Yeah, we've got owners chopping people's heads off, you know, we've got owners, but much then not like that. But anyway, go ahead.
I know. But true. But no, so it's a good sign. I mean, look, it's a good sign. And the thing that I would, you know, say in general on this, because they're meeting with other people as well, other directors across Europe. And I want to say that in particular, I believe this is regarding sales. That's my belief, or my sort of understanding it is specifically regarding sales. And I'll tell you why. Last week on some of my videos after our last podcast, I gotten some good information regarding, you know, we've talked about these players before on our show plenty, but United making contacts, initial contacts over Gerard Braithwaite and Michael.
I don't think he was that great at the weekend.
I thought he was decent. I don't think he had much to do, but he wasn't one of the center backs that gave away a penalty.
That's good, but go ahead.
And you know that United have made contacts with these representatives around the players and are starting to move forward on these sort of deals and make progress. You don't really need to meet with sporting directors to look at players that you already know you want to buy. But one of the things that United have been really poor at over the years, where they have been entirely non-proactive, is on sales, on player sales. Most of the time, they'll sit and wait for an agent to bring them an offer for a player. And I understand that is often the agent's job is to bring offers for players that want to leave or want to make a change this summer during their career. But being proactive in making good relationships that allow you to say, hey, you know, we've got these players who are potentially available or potentially on the move this year. I think is something they wouldn't have done in the past because of the misguided idea that doing so would mean teams know you want to sell and now they're going to offer you bad deals. And then you end up not selling them and they end up rotting on the bench for the next 3 or 4 years. And so I think there's a lot of proactive work being done on letting teams know, look, these are players, yeah, that we will consider selling, that we will consider available, because it's better to make. Yeah, you've got, I mean, look at the players you've got. Rafa Varane's probably leaving for free, Anthony Martial for free. But you have Greenwood, Sancho, Casemiro, Eriksen, potentially Wan-Bissaka, right? You know, yeah, the left back situation, if they're going to get one, are you keeping both Malacia and Luke Shaw, though neither is probably at their highest value at this moment in time? You've got agreed. So one of them's probably going to have to be sold too, though, because you're not having three senior left backs, you know, as well as.
I think Malacia is letting loan James and
fulfilling. Yeah, that's true. See if he can get healthy. Yeah.
Because, you know, talking about a £12 million left back here, United never, it wasn't a gamble, really. I mean, if it didn't work, it doesn't work. It's not getting that word. But yeah, go ahead, Zach.
Yeah, and then you've got the young players too, you know, Hannibal on loan that hasn't done so great, I think, at this point in time.
Again, they won 3-2, but it didn't play well, I hear.
Yeah, Pellistri's done well, but you still don't know if they're going to be able to buy him or exercise an option. You don't know the finances. So there's a lot of players where United are going to need to be pretty proactive in saying, hey, they're available. Is there going to be any interest from you? Is there going to be anybody that you might want? And making those kind of relationships and not being so stingy of not selling players for less than their value, which is a poor look because they end up having no value and you end up paying them to sit around doing nothing for years, like happened to, you know, players like Phil Jones and others as well, where it just doesn't work for anybody. And so I think that that's where they're being really, really proactive. And it's likely the main subject of meetings with people like Deco and at these different clubs is regarding that for sure. I think that's the most likely scenario.
I think the days of the £150 million transfer fees are gone. I don't think I think football's bubbles burst on that. I just don't see with the PSR FFP rules having teeth that I don't think the clubs are going to do that anymore. It's really difficult to justify doing stuff like that. There's obviously, you know, they're still looking at, I know they do like Palacios quite a bit. We've talked about that on here. Interesting to see what they end up doing on the midfield. Lastly, just want to ask you about the Solskjaer interview, because some interesting stuff in there that I thought was quite revealing. One of the things was the convoluted way with which United pursued players, which we knew, of course, which was just truly astonishing to me that we've got enough reports on Erling Haaland when I was saying him. But he said something that he'd touched on before about Ronaldo, saying that it didn't work out for either party. And clearly Ronaldo was a disruptive influence inside the dressing room. For rightly or wrongly, Roy Keane defended Ronaldo because he had standards. And I completely understand that argument too. And I would agree with a lot of that. But he had also talked about some of the other things going on inside the club and the fact that the Glazers had told them every year their top four was the goal, which is something that we've all known. Anything else you want to pick out from that?
Not particularly. I mean, most of it is not totally surprising, as we know. Unfortunately, it's confirmation, right, of a lot of it. you know, I thought it's really nice to that we're getting a little bit more of that kind of stuff firsthand from people, because I think it really starts to set it in. And it's the right time, seemingly, that we're getting a lot of this right after we've got new leadership in, which...
Yeah, all those NDAs. Oh, are
I know.
Yeah, you've done a done an interview as well, and now we're starting to see a lot of this come out, yeah.
So, I know, and it's good that we have new leadership, because... You know, this is why it was sort of hopeless without these people in place. You know what I mean? Like, when you look at how things were operating, it was hopeless. There's no way that we would have ever been successful. It is impossible. You can't even luck into it. You just can't. It's not like in U.S. sports, because of the way that the caps work and things like that, you can luck into being competitive in short spurts with top players, things like that. That can happen. Draft picks, you know, all of that. It's not like that in the Premier League. There was no chance with the way things were being run to ever be successful. So it makes it every time when these things come out more relieving every single day that there's different people making the decisions now.
Yeah, when it all gets laid bare, you look at it. I mean, it's not stuff, like you said, it's a major shock. But when you look at it, it's just truly unbelievable how deliberate it was, and how the scandalous incompetence of it all, and the steadfast refusal to listen to anyone. I mean, all the structures that, you know, they should have copied were already in place, and for some reason they refused to do it. And
on that note, I mean, I think this is a little bit more of a philosophical. Philosophical take, I guess. I've always been a bit of the opinion that when things happen, there's usually more of when it involves people, there's usually a little more purpose behind it than people are letting on. And when something is bad for a long time, it is not an accident.
Oh no, it's not bad luck.
It's not even often. I would say, like when you kind of learn this when running a business and things like that too, it's not an accident, and it's not. Just like it's usually not just incompetence, it's on purpose.
It is very
purposeful when these things are happening. It is not just like, oops, they didn't know any better. It's on purpose most
that's
of the time.
Derivative of personality and priorities, and that is you know, sustained excellence is not an accident, and sustained failure is not an accident, because at some point the failures become obvious, and if you refuse to address them, that's not an accident. You know, so that is absolutely 100% derivative of the people at the top. That's it. You know, I agree that this is where, if I was a Chelsea fan, I would be concerned, because I said sustained failure does not result in change. Okay. Mm-hmm. And inevitable change, people can be committed to that failure because there's some dividend or some payoff that you don't see that they value more, and they're okay with all the rest of it. Okay, mate. Quick prediction for Liverpool.
I can't see it going well. They're up 5-1 in their Europa tie, which they play on Thursday, which means they're going to play a heavily rotated side and be completely at full strength on Sunday with Mohamed Salah back in the team, all of that. I can't see it. I honestly can't. I can't see anything but a pretty bad... Salah against Lindelof,
And to me, it was no surprise if Foden...
It'd be nice if we took Wan-Bissaka back in for a game and stuck him over there to deal with it, because he's done a job before. But
let's see who's actually remains fit by the weekend.
Exactly.
Is there a chance of Haaland playing?
There is, right? I think Maguire, and Wan-Bissaka are all in the same boat where they could be fit for Liverpool. Starting, I don't know. It's not that long out. He hasn't been out that long where you need like a long reintegration period or anything, though. So potentially, I think we could have used him last time. You know, when we actually caught Liverpool a little bit, they played pretty poorly, and he played last time. But I think we could have
scored in that game.
Yeah, we should have scored in that game, and I think he's got his. What's that?
He should have scored in that game.
But
five, 6 weeks, I think, would have scored.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's why where my thinking got mixed up there. He's been in much better form since then. And I think in the same circumstances, he'd be still scoring those chances he had in that game. So it would be good to have him for sure. But yeah, I think another pragmatic game similar to the game against City is probably in order to give us the best chance to win. I can't personally criticize that approach. I've said that before with the things I have criticized about Ten Hag. I wouldn't criticize a pragmatic approach to these games at all, especially it's a cup game and all that too. It's like nothing matters except if you can get the win in a game like this. So
he doesn't have the players to play any other way, James. You can't ask the players to do anything different than what we're doing. But we shall see. All right, we'll leave it there. Thanks to all of you for downloading the podcast. As always, we will be back next week. In the event you miss us, just follow one of the aggregator accounts. They'll have no problem stealing content anyway and putting it on their accounts. Brazen Mastered. Thanks to all of you for, as you say, downloading, following the show and getting in touch with us through the week. It's much appreciated. I hope you're all well. Take it easy, mate.
See you later.